Welcome, council. This is Division 4 of the Colorado Court of Appeals. This case is Fleming against ICAO, case number 09CA2595. Counsel, did you receive the instructions for oral argument?
Yes, Your Honor.
And do you have any questions about them?
No.
All right, if anyone's come into the courtroom since 9 o'clock, please make sure your cell phone is turned off. We'll proceed. Mr. McDonald, you can raise that podium if you like. There's a toggle switch.
My name is William McDonald, number 12393. I represent the appellant claimant, Carl Fleming. This is a really simple appeal. Under the workers' comp system, case starts usually with an admission of liability or a determination by a judge that the case is compensable. Treatment goes on, benefits generally go on, and it comes to an end. The first endpoint is when the authorized treating physician, or in this case there were three ATPs because there were different specialties involved, they get to the point of maximum medical improvement. That's where they sort of throw their hands up and say, well, there's nothing more for us to do in terms of affirmative treatment that we can reasonably expect to improve your condition. You're not cured. You may not be done. Time may heal all wounds, but there's nothing more for us to do. And that point is maximum medical improvement, or MMI. At MMI, the ATPs give a date of MMI, and that's important because temporary disability benefits end because your condition is no longer considered temporary. They also give impairment ratings, which are along with your temporary disability rate and your age. Those are the factors that go into your permanent partial disability award in Colorado. That happened after 4 years of treatment in this case.
Ask you one question, counsel. Is that all they find, MMI and impairment ratings? Do they make any determinations under the statute as to causation and things like that?
Well, that is inherent in the MMI determination. If they say none of this was caused by the on-the-job injury, there is no date of MMI because there is no on-the-job injury at which to arrive at MMI.
I thought under a final admission of liability, they might not have to find causation.
Well, if they don't find causation, then if there is no condition whatsoever, then there is no date of MMI. MMI is
causation. Causation is inherent, is what you're saying.
Yes.
Thank you.
But counsel, isn't the issue of causation not one that is subject to the dime presumption that has to be rebutted? Isn't causation for the hearing officer, not for the dime?
Causation, this is the Leprino case that I cited. Causation has two meanings in comp, two applications. The first application of causation is, was there an on-the-job injury, a compensable injury at all?
Yes.
That's the judge's bailiwick. And in this case, for 4 years, it was under an admission of liability. Then they raised the issue of withdrawing the admission ab initio in front of the judge, and he said no, there was a compensable injury. So that has been, through admission and then finding by Judge Friend, an unbroken string of causation for the root issue of, is there a compensable injury at all? Once you get past that, and we get to either the ATPs or the dime doctor and their determinations, now it's their bailiwick. And their determinations are final and binding on everyone, unless if it's the ATP.
As to what? Their findings as to what? The extent of injury, compensable injury?
The extent of injury, the components of injury, how they calculate the impairment ratings under the AMA guidelines and the rules.
So for
example, the state of MMI.
So for example, they might say, well, this injury to the back was caused and is compensable. The claimant's also complaining of a injury to the neck, the upper neck or the shoulder, and the ATP says, I don't think that was caused by this particular accident.
Well, then if that's how he bases his report of MMI and impairment, it would be up to the claimant to ask for a dime to appeal that.
To appeal the causation.
And if a dime said that, it would be up to the claimant, if the claimant lost that determination, to ask for a hearing within 30 days of the date the final admission was mailed out.
What I want to be clear about is when it does go to the ATP, the ATP considers the nature, extent, and components of the injury and might say some of the complaints here are not compensable. They were not caused.
He can say some aren't. He can say additional things are that were missed before.
Good.
The dime can say the ATP blew the diagnosis, didn't do the right test, didn't find what he should have found if he'd have done the proper evaluation. And once the dime says it, the carrier has 30 days to ask for a hearing in front of a judge. And if they don't, they file a final admission of liability. That's their only other option under the rule. And then from that day, the day the final admission goes out, the claimant has 30 days to ask for a hearing in front of a judge. If nobody asks for that hearing, it's binding on everybody. And it's the same with the ATP's findings. The carrier gets the report. They either ask for a dime or file a final admission of liability consistent with the report. They're not given any latitude to cherry pick this, that, or the other thing. In this case, they filed the final admission. That's a judicial admission that they accepted the findings and determinations of the ATPs.
Let me back you up a minute. So you say it's the same for the ATPs. If you don't timely contest that, then you're stuck with them at some point. Your statute you're relying on, is that 8-42-107.2-2B?
2B or 2B2.
Okay.
A lot of twos and Bs in this case.
Got it.
And it flat out says it's binding.
Your position is that means it's jurisdictional, can't be revisited.
Well, that's my position. That's the judge's position. That's the panel's decision. Well, that's their position in every case but this one.
Let me ask you, because the cases you cite to us have to do with dime determinations are binding, not ATP determinations are binding. What's the critical language that's used in statutes that divide jurisdictional from non-jurisdictional but procedural matters?
The language is in the statute you mentioned that said it's binding on the director and the parties.
So if we look in comparable statutes in other contexts, if we find binding on the parties, that'll be a jurisdictional statute.
I don't know of another context with comparable statutes.
Okay.
Basically, I do workers' comp claims, and I wouldn't try to say I know all the law.
Let's go back to the dime. Let's go to the dime statute, the one you're analogizing it to. In that statute, do they say binding upon the parties?
I believe it does.
Okay. Thank you.
I mean, it's the same system. Once you get the ATP's findings and determinations, you either agree with them or you contest them, period. If you don't, they're binding. It's the same thing with the dime, except in the first case, you're asking for the dime. In the second case, you're asking for a hearing in front of a judge.
So here we have a dime that says that the claimant's not at MMI.
The dime in this case is now moot. The dime did say he's not at MMI, and then he went back into several years more treatment.
Okay, so the settlement, there was a settlement. The settlement was vacated.
Yes.
And go ahead from there.
What we're dealing with here is the ATP's reports. They didn't challenge it. Claimant didn't challenge it. It's the end of the discussion of whether the ATPs were correct or incorrect. What Judge Friend did, after claimant set this for a hearing on the two issues that remain, permanent total disability and continuing medical care in the future, he went back and rewrote all the DIMES findings and determinations. And he said, oh no, they were wrong. This was only a couple of 3 months aggravation of pre-existing problems, and the claimant went back to baseline. All of those findings are nullities.
So let me understand, because you're referring now to the dime that you say is moot.
Yes.
Okay. So in that dime, it was determined that the claimant was not at MMI.
Yes, determined that he said he needed more testing to really figure out exactly what the condition was.
And the causation determination in that dime was what?
Was there something going on? We don't know what it is, and it's related to this claim. Otherwise, I can't make a finding of not at MMI.
Because the dime concluded that the claimant had not reached MMI, at that point, there was no basis for an impairment reading.
Correct? Yeah, it would be premature.
Okay. And are you saying then that there were subsequent ATBs that then rated the claimant, and that at that point there was never a requested DMI dime?
Correct. Okay. They filed a final admission of liability. 30% impairment of the brain, 8% impairment for psychological, and 10% impairment of the shoulder.
And then based upon that admission there, I gather, and later discussions, there was a settlement agreement entered into at that point?
No, it was far earlier. It was 3 months after
all
the
right.
dime.
Okay.
The dime has nothing to do with this appeal.
But you're saying that Judge Friendly went back and revisited the dime?
No, he revisited the findings of the ATPs.
Oh, okay.
Which came in years after the dime.
All right, I thought you referred to the
and
dime.
And at that time, he had no jurisdiction to challenge
all
it.
All right, well, that's your conclusion, and that's the conclusion you want us to reach, and that's what I want to understand is how you're analyzing that.
I'm just applying the statute out.
Mr. McDonald, for me to understand your argument, it would be helpful if I can ask you some questions.
Oh, sure.
So it is my understanding that there was an FAL, and that the FAL admitted the ATP's statement that the claimant is at MMI.
Yes.
And the ATP said all of the injuries that he was complaining of were caused by this industrial accident.
One small part wasn't, and to understand that, you have to understand the ratings. For a shoulder rating, it's pretty straightforward. We have apportionment, which means you take out any pre-existing shoulder rating. There wasn't any. He didn't find any pre-existing psychological rating. No apportionment there. For the brain, you don't just have one number to rate the brain. You rate five different portions of brain function. He did apportion part of the seizure portion of the rating. But when you rate the brain, you only use the highest number. That was for cognitive function. That was not apportioned. So he addressed apportionment. He didn't actually reduce it.
So then Judge Friend came in after that, after the FAL that admits all of this. And what's the distinction between what the ALJ concluded and what the ATP?
With the ATPs, he had 4 years of temporary disability benefits, a large impairment rating, and a lot of 4 years of medical treatment. It was ongoing. He was on 9 medications at MMI. Still on most of them, I believe. Judge Friend went back and said, no, in the date of injury, he had a few months of aggravation of his pre-existing problems, and that's it. Nothing after that is related. And that's what he can't do.
And I understand your position that because nobody challenged the ATPs in a timely fashion, that the ALJ is stuck with them as a matter of jurisdiction.
He has to adopt them as if they were his own findings.
Let me ask you a question, counsel. And the question is this. What difference does it make that they had a settlement and it was reopened? Does the time start again for challenging the ATP?
No. The settlement, and this was a misleading thing in their brief. The dime report was in February. They have 30 days to either admit or challenge it. 90 days later is when the settlement was signed. Their time had long run.
I thought you were talking about challenging the ATP findings. You just said the dime report.
I'm sorry. I got confused.
Okay.
They had 30 days to either file a final admission or challenge
it. The dime.
With a dime, and they didn't.
Okay.
And the panel agrees in every case they've run through except this one. And the panel is very clear. You file your appeal a day late, no jurisdiction. File for the dime a day late, no jurisdiction. Challenge the dime findings, day late, no jurisdiction. Somehow they just can't understand how it applies in this case.
The dime report and the settlement that was set aside, and the setting aside of the settlement agreement, all came before the ATP report?
Years before.
And what was the reason given for the failure to request a dime after receiving the ATPs?
They filed the final admission instead. They made the conscious decision to admit liability.
And then they sought to withdraw that, is that correct?
They sought to withdraw their admission ab initio, their entire admission on the case. They were trying to get a ruling that there was no compensable injury at all. And that is in the bailiwick of the judge. But he found against them on that. Then he tried to limit it to 2 or 3 months, which he can't do.
Thank you, Mr. McDonald. Do you have another question?
I have another question. And if the hearing is limited to not let's get some money back from the claimant based on what's happened in the past, but let's deny future medical benefits and maybe permanent total disability, your position is they're still stuck with the ATP findings?
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you.
And the judge has to embrace those as if they were his own findings.
Thank
he can't
you.
Fight it.
That toggle will lower it. One of them will. There you go.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Doug Thomas. I represent the respondents in this matter, Giessen Restaurants Enterprises, LLC, and Truck Insurance Exchange. The primary issue presented during this appeal is whether an administrative law judge had subject matter jurisdiction to determine an injured worker's entitlement to future medical benefits and permanent total disability benefits under the Workers' Compensation Act. And our answer is yes. Obviously, the administrative law judge did have subject matter jurisdiction to make those determinations. First of all, as cited in our brief, the statute expressly gives, statute being 843-201, expressly gives the director of the Division of Workers' Compensation and the administrative law judges in the Office of Administrative Courts, original jurisdiction to hear and decide matters arising under the Workers' Compensation Act.
How about did it lose jurisdiction because there was a failure to timely contest the ATP determinations?
Your Honor, claimant objects to counsel's statement of the issue. It's never been our position that he doesn't have jurisdiction.
Counsel, we're gonna allow him to comment on his understanding of your brief. I will pose a question to Mr. Thomas. Mr. Thomas, apart from subject matter jurisdiction as such, was Judge Friend permitted to resolve questions of fact that apparently your opponent says were resolved with finality and could not be revisited?
Yes, he was. And let me continue on just a little bit. Let's say we put aside subject matter jurisdiction. Then the question is what would preclude an administrative law judge from making these factual determinations? What would that be? Is it some procedural mechanism? Is it some statutory mechanism? Is there a claim here for issue preclusion? And we understand the argument, which is difficult to decipher. It's somehow an evidentiary preclusion.
Well, counsel,
as I understand the argument that it's an authorized treating physician's opinions and evidence are binding?
Counsel, doesn't the statute make clear that with respect to impairment, not cause, but impairment, that unless there is a suitable challenge, either by the request of a dime, that the ALJ does not have the authority to overrule an ATP with respect to impairment?
Yes. I think that's a little bit of a broad sweep, but let me be clear. 842.107, subsection 2, insofar as the determination of medical impairment rating is concerned, the statute expressly says that the parties are bound by the treating physician's opinion with respect to medical impairment,
okay,
unless they go through this procedural IME process.
And the ALJ here found that there was a compensable injury. There was causation.
For a mild closed head injury, that is correct.
But is that impairment or is that causation?
It's none of the above. And I want to make that really clear. I think we need to get way back to the beginning here, that neither maximum medical improvement nor permanent medical impairment were at stake at this hearing. They were not at issue, not at issue in any way, shape, or form. And that's where I think that only two issues the judge decided that we're concerned with: future medical care, permanent total disability.
Well, let's go back then.
Yes.
I think you've made it clear in your briefs the MMI and impairment are not at issue with
correct.
This hearing, but
correct.
Remember, Mr. McDonald said there were two causation used in two different senses and that the ATP was allowed to make findings and determinations with respect to the causation, which is at issue in this case, and that those findings and determinations are subject to 842.107.22b as well. So go back and tell me why that's not right.
Okay, I couldn't disagree more. So let's start with the basics here. Maybe I need to even get further back. Conditions of recovery under the Workers' Compensation Act is 841.301. Conditions of recovery require an injured worker to demonstrate that they sustained an injury arising out of the course and scope of employment and that that injury is a proximate cause of their need for medical care and disability benefits. That's the first level of analysis of any benefit under the Workers' Compensation Act. Within this workers' compensation system, the legislature found that in order to quickly resolve certain types of disputes, they were going to enact an IME process, 1991. That IME process applies to two issues: maximum medical improvement, permanent medical impairment. Inherent, the courts have said that inherent in the determination of an impairment rating or MMI is this notion of causation. That's inherent there. If we separate out this little tiny dot from all the rest of the workers' comp benefits, maximum medical improvement, permanent impairment, inherent in that is causation. That has nothing to do with 90% of all other workers' compensation litigation. It's a little piece that the legislature has carved out to try and resolve those specific disputes. We always return to the basics, that conditions of recovery require the claimant to demonstrate that the benefit they seek is proximately caused by the industrial injury. So my answer to you, Judge Daly, is within this little teeny confine of MMI and impairment under 842.107, the treating physician's opinions, or if you invoke the division IME process, the division IME's opinions, or if you go to hearing after that, the judge's opinions, have certain evidentiary weight.
But if you never invoke that process, if that process doesn't apply because you're going to hearing on some other issues, none of that matters. We went to hearing here, compensability, future medical care, permanent total disability, none of it matters. No, none of that evidentiary stuff applies, none of the procedure applies. It simply doesn't matter.
I don't understand that. The ALJ here found that there was a compensable injury.
He did, limited to a mild.
And why is not at that point the ATP's report in terms of impairment binding?
No one's disputing permanent impairment. No one's disputing it. It's not at issue. Claimant had already received the maximum permanent partial disability award allowable under the Workers' Compensation Act. No one's disputing whether it's 30% or 20% or 10% or 2%. The only issue is he totally disabled? Is he totally disabled? So that doesn't apply. I want to, while you're on that topic, let's see if we can
explain that last statement. Why doesn't that apply?
Because we're not dealing with an issue of permanent medical impairment. We're not dealing with a medical issue of what is his impairment rating under the AMA Guides 3rd Edition Revised. We're dealing with his ability to work in the future. The standard for permanent total disability is set forth in 842.111, an entirely different statute. And that standard for permanent total disability is that the injured worker must establish that they're unable to earn wages in the same or other employment. That's the standard for establishing permanent total disability. That has nothing to do with your medical impairment rating under the AMA Guides 3rd Edition Revised that a doctor determines, or a division IME determines, or a judge determines.
So an ATP expresses no opinion, or is under the statute, is not contemplated to express an opinion about total disability?
That's absolutely correct.
Okay, how about this one? How about this one? What about the ATP's findings and determinations with respect to the need for future medical benefits? Because that was also an issue in this case.
That's true, Your Honor, and I believe that this court's issued an opinion directly on point in Story versus ICAO, cited in our answer brief, cited by the Industrial Claims Appeals Panel. This court has already determined that the heightened evidentiary burden of the Division IME process has no applicability to future medical care. Already determined. The heightened burden for the treating physician, the division IME, and later the hearing applies only to MMI and permanent impairment rating. The courts have already determined it has no applicability to future medical care. And the statute says it. The statute on its face, 842.107 sub 2, talks about finding and determinations of MMI and permanent impairment. It's a little niche carved out to resolve these little disputes. It has nothing to do with the rest of them. So statute says it on its face. Case law says it. Has no findings.
Saying that the statute does not contemplate either the ATP or the DIME the determination of, in terms of total impairment being binding, is that what you're saying?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, again, this is a little hard to put into an issue box. I tried to put it into the issue, but the plaintiff has tried to put it into the issue box of jurisdiction. They put it into the issue box of procedural mechanisms, then they've waived it, they haven't raised it below. If they put it into the context of claim preclusion or issue preclusion, those don't apply. They can only kind of put it into this evidentiary standard, otherwise they lose their appeal. And making an analogy to claim and issue preclusion maybe doesn't work here. But in the context of claim and issue preclusion, the Supreme Court has said in Sunny Acres Villas versus Cooper that issue preclusion does not apply to causation. And they talked about it in the context of an administrative law judge finding causation in a temporary disability case as opposed to a permanent total disability case. And the Supreme Court reasoned that if we were to find, first of all, issue preclusion doesn't apply because the parties don't have the same incentive to litigate it. Second of all, it's a different issue. They went on and on. But one of the things that the Supreme Court talked about, too, is if we make issue preclusion apply to everything in workers' compensation, then the employer has a strong incentive to litigate everything immediately. So I guess that applies to this sort of evidentiary argument that the injured worker is making here, too, is that if the employer doesn't immediately challenge anything a treating physician says, then they're going to be bound by it forever and ever and ever and ever in perpetuity for every benefit under the Workers' Compensation Act. And there's absolutely no case law that says that. There's no statute that says that, and there's no reason for that. The mere fact that a doctor holds an opinion that something's work-related is simply one opinion. It's not binding on the parties forever and ever in all issues, in all instances, and there's nothing that says that.
Let me see if I can't understand the frame in which you're presenting. As I understand the frame that you're presenting in is that as far as permanent total disability, there is a question of fact as to whether the person can be gainfully employed.
Absolutely.
And that question was properly in front of the ALJ.
That's correct.
And part of that, however, would be, if I understand correctly, it's possible a person could never be gainfully employed, but that is not caused by this industrial injury. It's really caused by some other factors, either a later injury or other medical condition. Is that part of your argument?
That is true, Your Honor. That is true. That's part of my argument.
All right. And so in this case, then, Judge Friend could address the question, one, whether this man could ever work again, and two, whether his inability to work is caused by this industrial accident.
Absolutely.
All right. So then as part of whether it's caused by this industrial accident, he has to look at what are the medical conditions that prevent him from working.
Sure.
And when he looks at what are the medical conditions that prevent him from working, if I understand your opponent correctly, he's saying that to the extent the ATP, the DIME, whatever else, the FAL, have all said that these are the medical conditions that were caused by this accident, the ALJ is bound by that determination of cause.
That is indeed the claimant's argument, as I understand it.
And if I understand his argument correctly, it is that when they failed to challenge the MMI by asking for a DIME and instead went to an FAL, that's it. They bought that causation.
And that's my understanding of his argument as well.
And it fails there, you say, and tell me again, why does it fail at that point? Maybe I should just see if I understand it. If I understand what you're saying, the ATP determines MMI, determines impairment rating. Inherent in that is a determination of causation. However, the final determination of causation is for the ALJ.
Yes, but I'm running out of time, so I want to make a really, really, really important point with respect to permanent total disability, and that is finding of fact number 45 by the administrative law judge. And what he said here is even assuming all of these conditions are work-related, I still find claimant capable of employment. So one of the things, when it comes to permanent total disability, a lot of what we're discussing here today is an exercise in theory, where it's nice for us to discuss it, it's nice for us to understand the history and mechanism of the Workers' Compensation Act, but at the end of the day, the administrative law judge says, I don't believe these conditions are causally related to your initial injury and you're not totally disabled. But even if they are, you're still not totally disabled. You're capable of working. He says it in finding number 45.
Well, let me ask you a question to see if I understand your position correctly then. With respect to the medical benefit, don't worry, I think Judge Carparelli will let you have a couple of seconds to answer and probably answer Judge Criswell if he has a question or two. But as I understand your position with respect to future medical benefits.
Yes.
And also, I think, total disability. Whatever an ATP has to say about those are not within the meaning of the statute findings and determinations that would be binding if not challenged by the dying process. Is that correct?
100%. Oh, absolutely. That is absolutely true because, again, the findings and determinations that would be binding if not challenged apply only to MMI and permanent impairment, do not apply to future medical care, do not apply to permanent total disability based on the plain language of the statute, based on the cases as to future medical benefits, especially the Story decision. That's true. To get back to your point, if I could, just to clean it up a little bit, I think that the answer here is that all of this stuff, Judge Carparelli, this stuff, whether it's the prior division IME, the prior order dealing with incompetency, the prior treating physician, the DIME, all of this stuff doesn't matter
because once that final admission was issued, the plaintiff themselves, the claimant, challenged those determinations. I don't accept any of it. We're going to have an administrative hearing, and we're going to determine two separate issues. And so all of that stuff just doesn't apply here. It always comes back to the fundamental question of conditions of recovery, compensability, causation, medical benefits, permanent total. And it's only those little issues that it would apply to. And again, remember, the plaintiff, neither the plaintiff or the defense has any incentive to challenge permanent impairment. The plaintiff's capped out. He's at the 120 grand cap. Makes no difference. So there's no incentive for anybody to argue over that. So why would anybody invoke that process? No one wants to go there because it makes no difference to relevant. But again, I think simply put, they don't. The statutory presumptions in that process apply only to those very narrow issues. They don't apply here. And as to permanent total disability, it would make no difference if they did, since the judge said, I find in any event he's capable of working.
Mr. Thomas, what can you explain to me the connection between the permanent impairment rating and the person's ability to work, in that if we have a binding determination that this person is permanently impaired to an extreme extent, doesn't that inform the ALJ's determination?
Zero. Absolutely okay. Zero.
All right.
In fact, there have been cases this court has looked at where the person has a 5% whole person impairment and has been declared totally disabled. And there are other instances where someone has a 50% medical impairment and have been found capable of working. It makes no difference. The factors in looking at permanent total disability are entirely different. Medical impairment by statute 842.107 is governed solely by the AMA guide's third edition revised. That's the pole star. That's the only thing. It's a medical determination. Permanent total disability.
Mr. Thomas, I'm going to cut you off there.
Okay. Let me just ask one simple question, which is really a matter that I could find out, I suppose, for myself. What, aside from future medical benefits, would the claimant have received by determination of total disability by the ALJ? Was there any other benefits? You say, does the cap apply to total?
No. Okay. No.
That answers my question.
No. And in fact,
Mr. Thomas, his question's answered. So,
all right. Thank you.
Mr. McDonald, I'm going to give you another 5 minutes to reply.
Running through their briefs and the final order of ICAP is this hazy, dreamy, cloudy notion of, we just can't figure out what the claimant's griping about here. Is this some evidentiary thing? Is this some kind of presumption? Is this a pleading problem? In our petition to review, we said the ALJ doesn't have subject matter jurisdiction to overturn the findings and determinations of the ATPs. We said that in 8 pages in our brief to ICAP. We said that in the notice of appeal here. We said that in 8 pages in our brief here, not counting the pages on you can't waive it, you can't create jurisdiction by estoppel, you don't have to raise it at any particular time, and no subsidiary issues. So this attempt to confuse the court by talking about, gee, is this an evidentiary problem or a pleading problem? That's absurd. It's an insult to the court.
Excuse me, counsel. I don't accept it. Your opponent has made an argument based on his analysis of the law. I do not accept that in this open forum that you would accuse him of what amounts to unprofessional behavior. So I strike that statement. I reject that. I would encourage you in the future not to argue on that basis. We want to hear your argument. We want to hear the legal premises and the analysis. We've heard his. We've given you more time to present yours.
The statute flatly says if they don't timely appeal the findings of the ATPs, it's binding on everybody. It couldn't be clearer.
And
case after case after case, the panel has ruled that.
And what is it that Judge Friend has done here that overturns, what particular part of Judge Friend's determination has overturned a particular part of an ATP's determination?
Okay, the ATP said as of the date of MMI, 4 years after the date of injury, he has, related to this on-the-job injury, 30% brain impairment, 8% psychological impairment, 10% shoulder impairment. And that was all three ATPs together.
And as I understood it, those were admitted and he received compensation based on that. Am I correct?
Yes, up to the cap.
Okay.
But he was also on nine medications, his medical treatment.
All right, counsel, wait, let me ask a question here. Are you arguing that the concept of total disability falls within the jurisdiction, if you want to call it that, of either the DIME or the ATP, and that is not reviewable by an ALJ?
No, I've never said that.
Okay, so that if the only issue before this ALJ was whether or not it was permanent, he would not be bound by the, he or she would not be bound by either the DIME or the ATP, right?
He's bound by their findings and determinations. Their findings are the findings of fact that go into what becomes the date of MMI and what's related and not related, and therefore goes into what's in the impairment rating.
But the issue of a total disability, i.e. ability to work in the future, is not one that the ALJ would be bound by, right?
No, and the doctors didn't make a statement about whether he can work in the future.
Okay.
So what is it that the ALJ then decided as a factual matter that overturned what the ATP decided?
Okay, the ALJ decided that from the date of injury, there were, and it's unclear exactly how many months, he meanders back and forth a little, a few months of aggravation of his pre-existing brain problem, and everything after that is unrelated. And that is overturning the ATP's opinions that as of 4 years later on the real date of MMI, this, that, and that were all related. He was still getting nine medications for the brain and psychological injuries. That's what he overturned.
And what effect did that then have on the outcome then? To the
it
extent
cuts off claimant's right to continuing medical benefits.
Isn't the question, counsel, what is encompassed within the term findings and determinations?
Yes,
opposing counsel characterizes it as only those things to which the IATT and DIME process would be binding, not with respect to other things, and you say differently.
And that leaves us with a situation where the claimant has one whole description of his medical, psychological condition for one purpose, but for another purpose, we're going to start with a blank slate and draw a completely different picture. And that is what is absurd.
It doesn't the alternative finding of the judge here, namely that even if all of these conditions did indeed exist, that he still would not be totally disabled, doesn't that overcome all that argument?
It doesn't overcome the determination of Judge Hank, who said he is mentally incompetent to enter into a contract. And workers' comp is based on contract of hire, wages under a contract of hire. If you can't enter into a contract, how can you be employed under a contract?
It also doesn't overturn the future medical benefits.
Yes, it does.
Okay.
Because the judge has to, as of the date of MMI, accept that the brain function, the psychological, and the shoulder are related to this, and the extent of the injury is as set forth in the ATP's reports. And the need for continuing medication is right there.
So do we have two issues here then with regard to the ALJ finds no permanent total disability and your argument regarding continuing medical benefits? We have those two issues.
Yes.
And your argument would be that they go hand in hand? That they, you know, once you decide...
They have commonalities. My argument, here's another way of putting it. As of the date of MMI, which is not in dispute, claimant did or didn't have this, that, or the other condition. There's no such thing as, for MMI, he has 30% brain impairment related to the injury, but for this other purpose, somehow he doesn't have that. You don't split him up.
So in this particular case, if I understand it correctly, then because of the earlier determinations, there would be a causation determination that it was binding on the ALJ, in which case continuing medical benefits must be premised on those existing findings.
And there's no evidence that he didn't need the medications. Well, they chose to try to withdraw the admission from the beginning.
All right, and the permanent total disability, your argument is, as I understand it, that to the extent that Judge Hank determined that that he was incompetent, then necessarily he must not be able to work.
Can't enter into a contract.
Okay, very good. Thank you both for your arguments and for your responses to our questions. This case now stands submitted. We will issue an opinion in due course.